Hi, this is Randall Schwartz, host of Floss Weekly. This week, we're going to be talking about brains, music brains, meta brains. You're not going to want to miss this, so stay tuned.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Floss Weekly is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com.
This is Floss Weekly with Randall Schwartz and Jonathan Bennett. Episode 410, recorded November 8th, 2016. Metabrains. This episode of Floss Weekly is brought to you by Braintree. Mobile app development can be complex, but integrating your payments no longer has to be. With Braintree, your business can accept nearly every type of payment from any device with just one integration. Learn more at BraintreePayments.com/floss. It's time for Floss Weekly, the show about free, Libre, open source software. I am your host, Randall Schwartz, Merlin at StoneEngine.com, bringing you each week the movers, the shakers, the big projects, the little projects, projects you may be using every day and unaware of it, as today's might actually be, projects you might want to download right after the show, or at least connect up with the project leader and see what's going on. All sorts of variety there. Joining me this week, as with almost every other week, I have a co-host, Jonathan Bennett. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Randall. It's good to be here.
That's got to be the most awkward introduction I've ever done. But hey, there's always time to set a new high and lows on this show. As I like to say, they let almost anybody run this show, apparently. Where are you speaking to us from?
I'm here in corporate headquarters, home office in Lawton, Oklahoma.
Well, but as we said before the show, Oklahoma, but you didn't feel those earthquakes from a couple days ago?
Not a thing.
Wow.
So part of the reason for this is I live right next to Fort Sill Army Base. It's like a mile that way. And okay. So they're doing artillery bombing all the time for their practicing. And so when I hear something that sounds like thunder or feel something shaking, my immediate thought is, oh, it's probably just Fort Sill. So it may have happened and I didn't notice it. There's only been one big one that I've actually felt and noticed. And that was big enough that the walls were shaking back and forth for several seconds. That's been a couple years ago.
Okay. Well, I'll believe that. You know, I was up with my brother, who lives sort of really near the JBLM, the joint Navy and Air Force base, and they were doing a lot of cannon firing or something large, rocket firing, and I remember hearing some of that and wondering, okay, is that something dangerous, or is that just some people firing off rockets? And apparently, that's all it was. But I'm not there today. You might notice a bit of a difference if you're watching the video. I am back in Santa Monica. I'm on the 11th floor of one of the tallest buildings in Santa Monica. I'm at the ZipRecruiter headquarters, and they graciously allow me to have this spot. Behind me, you can't see it because it's all washed out because of the contrast, is the ocean. And if it was a slightly less contrasty day, you'd actually see some of the blue there. But no, we've basically got no clouds in the sky right now, which is sort of annoying. I actually prefer a few clouds. Anyway, enough about this week in locations. Let's actually go into what today's show is about. Today's show is interesting, like all the other ones. I don't know how to make it relatively interesting or not. We've got music brains. Oops, I even blew that already. It's Metabrains. Metabrains is a project that's been around for a while, at least 10 years. And the project is sort of the parent project of a number of very specific projects. The one I know the most about is Music Brains. I remember coming across Music Brains when I first got my Mac laptop that had iTunes on it. And I would take a CD and I would rip the CD, and then I would get these, legally, because I own the CD. Okay, we're not talking about piracy here, guys. This is like taking actual music you own. But then you get it into iTunes, and all it says is track one, track two, track three. And you go, what songs were on there? And then you'd have to sit there and type all that in. Well, the guys at Music Brains, the brilliant people at Music Brains, figured out how to upload maybe a signature for the song, or maybe a portion of the song, or maybe it's just based on the lengths of the song. I don't know how it happens. In fact, we probably have somebody on who can actually tell us about this in a few minutes. But basically, it would figure out the names of the tracks, and poof, there would be all of my tracks, appropriately labeled album, everything. And I was just fascinated by this whole thing. And And for the ones, you know, their database was seeded by people who actually had gone through all the work of typing it in. So occasionally I would do a song base and it didn't have all the names, and I would spend my time typing it in, and I would have anyway. And then I would say, upload this. So I was contributing to this collective database then of various song samples and sounds like that. The MetaBrains project is more than just about this. I should actually have that page up right now. They also cover things like Critique Brains, which is about music critics and raw data, Book Brains, Messy Brains, Listen Brains, Acoustic Brains, Cover Art Archive, and so on. We will definitely be asking questions about these collection of projects when we bring our guest on, whose name is now buried but behind my Safari window. Come on, there we go. It's Frederick Frezzo Olson. And I probably mispronounced his last name or maybe even his first name, but we'll go by Prezzo as his official name here. Or actually, no, we'll go by Frezzo when that's his actual official name. I need more caffeine. I think that's what this actually means. I didn't get enough sleep. The daylight savings time has thrown me off. The whole election thing has thrown me off. Well, let me go by this way. Jonathan, fill in, please, what you think you know about this project.
I'll come in and rescue you.
Please.
So yes, I've got a very similar experience with the idea of tagging MP3s and FLAX. And that is, you know, you've got a whole bunch of CDs that you own, and you want to be able to rip them to your computer so that you can then, you know, put them on your phone or whatever. And you don't want to sit there and... The worst thing is having 300 track ones and 300 track twos and trying to figure out which one's which. So then you have to sit there and type each of them out. And it's just, it's great that there's this place that you can go and download the metadata for each of them. And you know, you think about it, and this is one of kind of the essential concepts of open source is why reinvent the wheel? Why should everyone have to in this case, type in their own metadata, their own track names? We should be able to set up a system where one person does it once really well, and then everybody else can benefit from that. And so I think it's almost a very pure essence of open source what they're doing here. So I think it'll be a very good topic to interview and learn more about.
Yeah, so instead of us chatting back and forth and me digging even a deeper hole, similar to the hole I digged last week. Let me go ahead. And just before we're gonna bring on Frezzo in a moment. But before we do this, I need to speak with some seriousness because this episode of Floss Weekly is brought to you by Braintree. By next year, maybe even next week, there could be a whole new way to pay. Maybe it will be the next Bitcoin or the next Apple Pay or maybe even both. Fortunately, Braintree's full-stack payment platform is easily adaptable to whatever the future holds, so you can adapt easily too. Accept everything from pounds to PayPal. That next big innovation from any device with just one integration. And when that new payment method comes along, all you have to do is update a few lines of code. No late nights, no complicated recoding, no stress about staying ahead of the curve. Braintree Payments is here to help. Because they're simple and secure payments code you can integrate quickly. The Braintree code supports Android, iOS, and JavaScript clients. And there's SDKs in 7 languages, .NET, Node.js, Java, Perl, yay Perl, PHP, Python, and Ruby, and with elegant code and clear documentation. Braintree offers you an easy way to accept multiple payment types with one integration. Integrating it into your app is as easy as inserting a few lines of code. You can learn more at braintreepayments.com/floss. We really appreciate the support of Braintree for Floss Weekly. And now let's go ahead and bring on our guest. Frezzo, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
All right. Hello. All right. So ignoring the whole opening, where are you speaking to us from?
I am actually in the MetaBrains office we have here in Barcelona, Spain. And if it's a bit dark outside, it's actually, what's it like, 6:30 p.m. here.
Okay.
But otherwise, you would have some view of Barcelona behind me. Right now, you can just see all the... fences meant to scare the pigeons off, which is not really working that well. But
Oh, okay. Yes. And my experience at Barcelona is strictly from having docked on a cruise ship there about 5 or 6 times and walked up the main street that you can get to from the dock area and, you know, saw the open market, went to one of the restaurants. Some friends of mine went to, can I say this on this show, the Sex Museum? I didn't go. I don't know what was in there, but they were there on the main street there in Barcelona. Anyway, enough of that. Let's talk about MetaBrainz and things like I'm familiar with the Music Brainz thing. How did you get started and what was it like when you got started? I think the program existed and the project existed before you got started. So can you kind of say what it was like when you came in and what problems they were trying to solve back in the early day?
That's a long time ago. I started, my Music Brainz user was created in June of 2006. That's 10 years ago now. Mm-hmm. And the project is about 16 years old. So it had been around for a few years before I came in, but I've still been around for quite a while. I think I actually came to Music Brainz through Last.fm. For those who don't know, Last.fm is a service, which we'll probably also talk more about in a bit, which allows you to scrubble the music you are listening to the Last.fm website. And then you can go and see which artist that is. There you can see which artist you've listened to, and you can see which albums, which songs you've listened to the most. And you can then couple that data up with other services like Music Brainz to make a lot of different. And for some people who are geeky enough about the data, you can get some pretty interesting statistics out of that. The reason I then went from Last.fm is that to Music Brainz is that Last.fm used to use Music Brainz heavily in cleaning up all the data they got in their submissions. Mm. So the way to probably clean up Last.fm data was actually to make sure the proper data existed in Music Brainz, and to make sure that when you scrubble data from your whatever music player you were using, that it would have the Music Brainz IDs embedded in the tags, and then those IDs would, those Music Brainz IDs identifiers would be sent in the packets, in the scrubble package you would send to Last.fm, so Last.fm would know right from the get-go that this is the song in Music Brainz that you're listening to, so it wouldn't just be some song, like it wouldn't just be Billie Jean by Michael Jackson, but it would be the Billie Jean song on this specific album by Michael Jackson, by this specific Michael Jackson, and not one of the other people called Michael Jackson.
Mm.
How did
you go from just being a user of the service to actually volunteering and assisting then?
Well, that was pretty much straight away. My need for being on Music Brainz was for cleaning up and adding data. At the time, I've been playing folk music for about 15 years or something like that myself, and Danish folk music was not very well represented on Music Brainz 10 years ago. So obviously, my main focus at the time was just getting a lot of data about Danish folk music into Music Brainz, so Last.fm would pick it up probably. So I got started pretty much straight away in contributing, adding data to the database.
Okay, and then so let's back up a step and say, well, how was Music Brainz actually identifying the tracks? Was it looking at the relative length of the CD tracks that are next to each other, or is it actually listening to the sounds within a song?
Right, it can do both. What you would most commonly use is the tagger program called Music Brainz Picard, which used to be called Music Brainz Tagger. I think was the original name many mm-hmm. years ago. It's been Music Brains Picard for most of my time with the project. Exactly. And Music Brains Picard will use, either it will use the tag, the data that's already in the file, which includes like the track length, or if you already have some tag data in it, like the name of the album, the name of the track, the name of the artist, then it will take those data and search on the Music Brains website. And if it finds a match that's close enough, then it will return the album into Picard, and then you can tell Picard to tag that. But there's also another way you can do this, which a long time ago it was called TRM IDs, which didn't last long because they were pretty horrible. But basically it was a way of acoustically fingerprinting the specific acoustically fingerprinting a song. So like you would take my fingerprint and then you would be able to identify that as me. The same thing you can do with a piece of audio, which in this case is music, and say this does this kind of shift, and then you can do some magic and then you will have a fingerprint. The TRM IDs were the first incarnation of that, which was, I believe that was a closed source technology, which was then replaced by PU IDs, which were another proprietary closed source technology. And then the company that was behind the PU IDs, they got bought up by some company, I can't remember, and basically the PU ID service pretty much got discontinued. So one of the Music Brains community members, Luke's, what's his real name? Oh, jeez. Anyway, he invented Acoust ID, which is a completely open source acoustic fingerprinting technology. The website, the algorithm that Acoust ID uses for acoustically fingerprinting audio files is open source. The fingerprinting software itself is open source. The database running on the Acoust ID servers is open source. The acoustid.org website is open source. So it's an all open source endeavor, which we're really happy about, that we're finally able, this third iteration of Acoustic IDs is completely open, so we don't have to worry about another vendor shutting down on us and we'll be getting left out in the cold again. It also means that, unlike the TRM IDs were directly in the Music Brains database, the PU IDs were entered directly in the Music Brains database, but Acoust IDs is actually on another server. So you use the Music Brains idea from Music Brains, then you can look that Music Brains idea up in the Acoust IDs database to see whether it matches, or you can look up the acoustic fingerprint in the Acoust IDs database, and then you can get a Music Brains idea out of the Acoust IDs database and then look that up in Music Brains. And I would love to tell you a lot about how Acoust IDs works, but it's beyond me. It's not my area of expertise. For me, it's all magic.
Okay, so Music Brains is more than focused just on the metadata, not necessarily identifying tracks anymore like its original purpose was.
Yeah. Yeah, we...
Okay, okay, go ahead.
Yeah, Music Brains aim to be an extensive, all-encompassing music encyclopedia where we basically have all information about all music ever. which is a pretty lofty goal, but we are on the way there. We're not just about the digital media like CDs and like downloaded media. We also have information about wax rolls. We have information about works that may not have been recorded at all yet. We have information about recording studios. We have information about events like concerts and stuff where music will have been played and where artists will have performed. But there might not be an actual recording of the thing. But we're still interested in the data because it tells something about music and the people involved in music. So yeah, it's a lot more than just identifying music files.
Okay, I want to go a little more into this, but I want to at least also address a couple of questions that have come up in the chat room. And this is about the audio fingerprinting again. Well, it sounds like we're going to have those guys on at some point on the show because that is actually sound interesting as well. But the do you know if that software can be used similar to, say, someone would use SoundHound or Shazam to be able to identify, say, a snippet that they're listening to on the radio or something like that? Is that technology available through this other website?
No.
Okay.
That's a pretty Acoust ID is designed to analyze an entire file. You can't take it doesn't work like analyzing a bit of like just a small sound clip and then being able to infer that on like and then it's this track. You have to analyze the entire file to be able to say that this is the same piece of audio.
Okay, sadly, 40,000 people just went, oh. Anyway, so.
Yeah, I know. We would love to have a technology like Shazam, but the fact is that the algorithm that Shazam is using is publicly known, but it's also heavily patented. So you are not actually allowed to use the license. And there have been a couple of tries to try and use this to start an open source project around something similar to Shazam, but they have pretty much all been shut down for license or patent infringements. So,
software patents. We need to do a whole show on that at some point. but let's talk a little bit more about the music data. I subscribe to a number of streaming services because I have decided long ago that I would rent my music collection rather than buy it. So I spend a lot of time paying over and over again for music that I only listen to very little because I mostly listen to podcasts. No, but anyway, so I have all these streaming services, and there are certain ones, without doing any name dropping since these are commercial ventures, that have a really detailed meta information about music, like this artist also hung out with that artist or was on these albums with this other artist, or this piece of music has been recorded 16 times and here are some of the artists that have recorded that. I imagine that the people who are doing this in a proprietary way have gone through and spent a lot of great expense doing this. Is this the kind of data that you're hoping that Music Brains is collecting and is making available to people? And if so, what's your penetration depth? Do you think you have, say, the equivalent of some of these commercial services in terms of knowledge and understanding about relationship between albums and tracks and artists?
I definitely think we do have. I definitely think we are already there. And in fact, some of the streaming services out there, some of the commercial streaming services actually donating money to us in return for using our data. Is it okay for me to mention some names?
It is for you. I can't do it because I'm the show host, but you can say whatever you want. It's your guest.
Spotify is using our data to clean up the data they get from the labels, from the music labels. So Spotify is one of our big name customers, mm-hmm. Supporters. Google is using us a lot in their YouTube music data. And if you search on a musical artist in Google, sometimes you will have this little box of information next to the search results. I don't know if it's fully seeded by MusicBrainz data, but it's at least partially seeded by MusicBrainz data. Google Play Music is also using MusicBrainz data to some degree. I'm not exactly sure how much, but it is at least to some degree. Amazon Music is using MusicBrainz data for something. I'm not entirely sure, but they're another one of our supporters. BBC Music, basically anything that has to do with music in the British Broadcasting Service is hooked up on MusicBrainz data. They've basically replaced their internal database with MusicBrainz. So we have a lot of people who are already using MusicBrainz data for this. And another thing that's important to note, I would say, is that some of the people like the All Music Guide, they have a lot of information. And when I go through and I link up MusicBrainz ideas to All Music ideas, I will usually find that one artist in MusicBrainz will exist maybe three or four times, or maybe more times in All Music, for example. So while you can have the numbers of MusicBrainz having just over a million artists, and All Music Guide may have 2 million artists, a lot of those artists in All Music actually are duplicates of each other.
Ooh.
And there's also another thing. All Music is mostly has data provided by the labels. So they will mostly have data about commercial, like artists that have some kind of commercialness to the names, while a lot of MusicBrainz data is entered by enthusiasts. So MusicBrainz will have a lot of the long tail data of artists that are maybe not known to basically anyone other than the person who entered them in the first place into MusicBrainz. So MusicBrainz will have a lot of very deep data and very, very detailed data about music that may not have a very wide audience in the big scheme of things.
Well, it's really impressive that you have a number of commercial services being able to use your data. That only begs the question for me, under what license did I contribute my data in that makes that all legitimate, or is it?
Well, the core data of MusicBrainz, like all the basic facts, is, we believe, to be basically non-copyrightable because they're facts. In the EU, you have like the database clause where you can copyright like the sweat of the brow. So you can copyright the database. But since MusicBrainz is legally founded in the US, in California, We're under Californian law, under American law, so there's no sweat of the brow doctrine. So basically, the core of the database, which consists of facts, is from our end released as Creative Commons Zero, so basically public domain. Some data like the folksonomy tags and user ratings and a couple of other peripheral data is under a Creative Commons attribution, non-commercial, share alike, with a license to MusicBrainz to relicense for commercial uses. Yeah. So, but the vast amount, the far most of the data is basically a public domain.
Hey, I did want to ask a couple of things. So you talked about some of these companies. You said they're customers. Not customers, they're supporters. I have to ask, are you guys a for-profit, a non-profit? What does the MetaBrains organization look like?
The MetaBrains Foundation is a non-profit founded in, located in California. I can't remember the American legal term, 503 something, 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 I think. we're a non-profit.
Okay.
Which is why we don't have customers, but have supporters.
Understandable, but your supporters kind of feel like customers because they use the stuff and then they give back to the program to keep you guys running. That makes sense. So I wanted to ask a little bit about some of the other projects under the umbrella of MetaBrains. And one of the ones that caught my interest was BookBrains. Tell me a little bit about BookBrains. What is it? What is it for? How does it work?
Right. BookBrains is founded by, it was actually originally founded by one of the former employees of MetaBrains, Ollie Charles, an English guy who decided that Haskell was the best thing ever. So he quit MetaBrains to focus, to try and live off doing Haskell stuff, which I think he's actually kind of doing. He still sometimes checks in with the community, and I'm still friends with him on Facebook, so I keep in touch with him. It's currently being run by a guy called Sean in the US and a guy called Ben, who's in the UK. And the goal of BookBrains is basically to mimic what MusicBrains does, just for books and literature. The main issue that they had with why they wanted to make BookBrains is that there are a lot of book databases out there, Goodreads and a bunch of libraries who have some degrees of open data licenses for the data, and there are a lot of projects out there, but none of them are really, both have a completely open license, like MusicBrains, which is basically public domain, and at the same time, completely user and community edited. So BookBrains is kind of a way that they want to get this massive level of structure, of data structure that MusicBrains has, where you can basically link any two pieces of data together, and such get a massive interconnected web of information, at the same time as being completely open, and at the same time being actually edited and driven by the community of data users that are actually using the data. So that is the background for BookBrains.
So I've had a little bit of experience working with libraries that are going through their collection and trying to digitize all the information about their books. Would BookBrains be a useful resource for a small to medium library that wants to digitize all their metadata, so you know they can put it all into a database and people can sort through it? Can they just say, "Oh, it's this book," and then download all of that metadata from BookBrains? Is that kind of the idea?
Yep, that is very much the goal. BookBrains is not nearly as mature as MusicBrains. BookBrains has, the first public release of BookBrains was April 1st last year. Compared to MusicBrains with 16 years of history, BookBrains has a year and a half, and is still very in the very early stages of development. So, yeah.
Does BookBrains cooperate with either or any of the open source library management systems. One that comes to mind is Evergreen, I think, and there's another one that I can't remember the name of. Seems like it might be a good fit. Are you guys cooperating with them at all?
Not that I know of. As I said, the BookBrains project is run by the guys Ben Lodz-Sputnik and Sean Leftmostcat, and I don't think they have any collaborations with other projects as such yet. But I'll definitely pass it on to them. I think Leftmost at least will also be watching the recording of this of this podcast, so he will get the recommendation himself when he watches this.
Well, there you go. It seems like it's a natural fit. You guys ought to make it happen. I wanted to ask about the cover art database. I know it's very handy to be able to you rip your CD and you put it into your music program, and then the next thing you know, hey, there's cover art there. Here's what it looks like. My question is, how's that work with copyright? Aren't those pictures copyrighted?
Yes, they most likely are copyrighted. The problem is that nobody really knows who has the copyright. So is it the artist who designed the cover? Is it the artist who put out the release? Is it the record label? Is it the distributor? Is it some other instance? Is it some mix of these? Basically, the whole issue of copyright for cover art is such a gray area that no one really knows who has the copyright for any piece of cover art. So as you can see on this image, it's a collaboration with the Internet Archive. So basically, any cover art you upload will never touch any of MetaBrains' infrastructure. MetaBrains is never in contact with the cover art being uploaded. It's all going directly to the Internet Archive. So basically, we're kind of circumventing the whole copyright issue by offloading that to the Internet Archive. Since it's also a historical resource to be able to see how cover art has developed over the years, which is kind of what Internet Archive is all about, seeing how, like, archiving cultural heritage for the future generations. And Cover Art Archive is a natural fit because it's useful for MusicBrainz users to be able to see the cover art attached to a given release, not the least because a lot of cover art has a lot of very useful information about the releases, so we are able to glean off a lot of information from the cover art. And it's a natural fit for the Internet Archive because it allows them to cobble up this particular piece of cover art is the cover art for this specific release. It's a match made between the Internet Archive and MusicBrainz. And basically, MetaBrainz is hands off on the copyright. And if someone believes they have the copyright, they can file a DMCA with Internet Archive. And we know a couple of people have done it, but it's like, I think it's like less than 0.1% of cover art has been taken down on that account.
Well, it's an interesting concept because it's one of those. It's one of those moments where it's in the best interest of the people that own the copyright if it's available to people to be able to put in their music library. I mean, it encourages people to use the works, although I suppose that's not swayed the minds of a lot of other copyright owners. But I find it very interesting that you guys are kind of saying, oh, no, it's not our problem, but we might know a guy that knows where you can get this. If you go talk to the Internet Archive, they might.
Yeah, well, but exactly because it's like the whole copyright issue is actually also any music store, like Spotify, as I talked about earlier, they get the cover art from the labels. They send the cover art as part of the metadata they send when they send a release into Spotify system. but it's not actually entirely sure that the label is the one that has the rights to use or to distribute the cover art. But since it's in whoever, since it's in the best interest of the artist, the label, to be able to have some kind of visual identifier for the release, for the album in question, no one really seems to mind that a piece of cover art is associated with a given release album. So it's very rare that cover art will get people in trouble, as long as you don't try to sell the access to the cover art.
That's a very interesting equilibrium that you guys have discovered there. one of the other projects that caught my attention, just because it has such an interesting name, Messy Brains. What is Messy Brains?
Messy Brains is actually one of the least interesting. Well, I'm not sure if it's one of the least interesting. It's actually, from a technical standpoint, it's a very interesting project, but it's one of the least public in some way projects, because it's basically, if I can just talk about Listen Brains and Acoustic mm-hmm. Brains.
Go ahead.
Listen Brains is, as we talked about earlier, Last FM. Last FM has the fundamental issue that it's proprietary, that its database is closed, and it's been sold a few times to, I can't even remember who owns Last FM right now. But anyway, Last FM has had several issues with the API, basically just from one day to the next, just disappearing, and all access to the API just going away. It's, I think, most of the API functionality is back, if not all of it now. But there were, like, for half a year, if not more, there was quite a bit of uncertainty whether the API would ever come back. So Listen Brains was kind of created in this over a weekend or so, to be able to create an open source, open data replacement for alternative to Last FM. Yeah, that's one thing. So basically, you'll be able to scrubble data from your music player to Listen Brains, like you've been able to send data to Last FM so far. And we actually have an API that's one-to-one compatible to Last FM, so you can just replace Last.fm with listenbrains.org in your scrubbing software, and it should work. Listenbrains also has another API that allows you to send a lot more data than is possible in the Last.fm API. So hopefully, we are encouraging people who are looking into Listenbrains to use the Listenbrains API, because we can get a lot more interesting information that way. Acoustic Brains is a project that in collaboration with one of the universities here in Barcelona, which allows you to analyze, kind of like AcoustID, but not quite, which allows you to analyze your music files and submit this acoustic analysis to Acoustic Brains, which allows music researchers and other people to do a lot of interesting statistics and analysis on all of this collected data. You can tell, like, I don't know if you've heard about the what's it called, the gain wars, I think it is, where basically you cut out a lot of details about the in the music in order to make it sound louder. So you can sound louder than other music, and you can use the acoustic data submitted to Acoustic Brains to map this, to see how some of the acoustic values has been altered in the mastering process throughout the years.
So you can see how compressed, not data exactly, compression, but in the audio world compression, You can see how compressed each track is. Oh, that's interesting.
Exactly. And you can also see, like, you can make analysis, like, how big a percentage of music was in minor, how much was in major for various years. So, and, like, a lot of very nerdy, very geeky stuff that, again, it's beyond me. There's a whole music technology group department of the university that we're collaborating with here in Barcelona. There are a lot of very geeky students and professors and researchers there who are doing a lot of interesting stuff. And there's another university in London who's also using this, and a lot of universities with a somewhat less permanent connection with MetaBrains, who are using all of this data for their research. Anyway, all this talk about listen brains and talk about acoustic brains was actually so we could talk about MetaBrains, because ideally, all music you submit to listen brains, all music you submit to acoustic brains will have music brains identifiers. But we don't live in an ideal world. So sometimes you will want to submit an audio file to acoustic brains or submit a listen of an audio file to listen brains that does not have music brains identifiers. And basically what MetaBrains is supposed to be is that the data submitted to acoustic brains or the data submitted to listen brains will go into the MetaBrains system and get a MetaBrains identifier instead of a music brains identifier, which will allow theoretically people to later go in and say the listens or the acoustic data which relates to this MetaBrains idea actually belongs to this music brains ID. So you can at some later point link up the MetaBrains data with the music brains data. It's kind of a way to make sure we can receive data without it being linked up to music brains in the first place.
It allows you guys to take this potentially very useful data and pull it into the umbrella, but not directly water down, not directly defile the kind of the pristine data that is in music brains. So it's exactly. It's kind of a holding tank in between the two before you can sort it all out. Is that how it works?
Exactly. That's the idea.
All right. Very cool. Appreciate that.
So I've got a couple more questions. We're getting close to running out of time, but Tinker Toy Tech, who actually asked this question even before we started today, and I said, no, wait till the show started. I don't want to lose your material here. So the question is, has Music Brains Picard been tested on very large to huge projects, like scanning and tagging a million tracks for untagged files that have been added but not tagged before and added to a radio station that is poorly moved to automation? I think that's roughly the question. Does that make sense to you, and can you answer that for us?
It does. I do understand the question, and I actually have no idea. I know that Music Brains Picard basically moves when you load a file into Music Brains Picard, Picard will keep all the information about the file in memory. So if you load a million files into Picard, you will likely, in the best case scenario, crash Picard. So the workaround is basically to work in smaller chunks. So instead of loading all your 3 terabytes of data into Picard at one time, loaded into smaller chunks of maybe 1,000 files at a time, in some way. Or you can use another project like Beats, which is not a MetaBrains project, but they are very heavy users at Music Brains, and I'm working quite a bit with the Beats lead developer as well. Yeah, so that's definitely another project to check out. I can't remember the website right now. But that's definitely another project. And Beats also uses Acoust ID for acoustic fingerprinting, and it also does, like Picard, it also checks already existing tags in the files to search Music Brains' database to try and find matches. And Beats is very well suited to work on a huge chunk of data, since it's Beats is meant to be scripted. Picard is very much meant to be manually checked. Picard is not supposed to just load in a bunch of files and then press save and then hope everything works out fine. Beats, on the other hand, is made for automated tasks.
Okay, and like I said, we're almost out of time, but I really do want to get to probably the two most important things about all this. I mean, now that I think our audience has a pretty good sense of the projects that MetaBrains has under its umbrella, let's talk about two groups of people. The first of which would be the people that are working most closely with you, probably, to update the software, manage the website, do the translations, sort of the key engineers, if this were a company, the people that actually be working for the company. But I want to distinguish them just a little bit from the people who are actually using this stuff, because I imagine that you have the notion of a customer out there. I mean, like, I maybe would never contribute to the software of Music Brains, but I was a heavy user of it to tag my data. What are you doing as the community coordinator to address both of those arenas of people? And then more specifically, what are the kinds of people that you need to help you along in your missions? Big question.
Yeah, very big question. Wow. Well, obviously we have a lot of like personal users who use Music Brains for tagging their music collections. Either from CD rips or from when they download music from the iTunes store or from Bandcamp or other sources like that. iTunes is known for having terrible data, and Bandcamp has very limited data. So obviously we have a lot of people who use Music Brains for completely personal reasons. Then we have a lot of people like myself. I started out for personal reasons, and I was just like, but I want all the data. I was just like, my OCD just took over and just, oh, but then this artist appeared in this album that I just entered. So now I have to enter this artist's complete discography into Music Brains, and this artist collaborated with this other artist. So now I have to enter that artist's complete discography into Music Brains. And you can probably imagine that at easily spirals way out of hand, and we have a bunch of core contributors who are very, very OCD about their metadata, and basically it's just a never-ending project, and there's always more data to enter. So obviously we have a lot of that, and then we have like big people like the BBC, as I told about. BBC actually sometimes have some people employed to enter data into Music Brains because, as I said, they have basically replaced their internal database with Music Brains, which means that if they need to play some artist on their on the radio, that artist needs to be in Music Brains, and most of the time they will get the artist themselves or the artist management to enter their data. But sometimes BBC will have people inside BBC to enter that data. We also have a lot of artists labels and artist managers who are on Music Brains and entering the data for themselves and their artists because it's it helps. It makes it easier for the artist to get sorted properly in Spotify and to appear on, in Google searches and stuff like that. But we also have But what am I doing as a community as a community manager? Most of the time, I'm just following along with the community, with the ISC chat rooms, with our forums, trying to keep up with some. We have if two editors disagree on how to do some edits sometimes, exactly because we're so passionate about the metadata for our favorite artists and our favorite labels and whatever. So sometimes people will get really like, but you're not doing it the right way. And it's part of my job to step in and say, okay, take a breath and just let's work this out. I'm also running in charge of running some projects like the Google Coden, which we actually just got word from yesterday that we accepted in again this year for our second year. Mm-hmm. Google Coden is a competition Google runs for pre-university students from 13 to 17 years of age, where they can do a lot of small tasks in a lot of different organizations. KDE is another organization, and the Wikimedia Foundation, the group behind the Wikipedia, have been accepted again this year, and a bunch of other really cool open source organizations are a part of this Google Coden, which is a really great program. If you've heard of the Google Summer of Code, it's kind of like the little sister of the Summer of Code, where Summer of Code is like one big project which one student works on throughout the summer. Google Coden is a lot of very small tasks that a lot of different people can work on over the winter, northern hemisphere winter. We're very excited. We're just getting ready. There you can see all the very cool organizations having been accepted. Ooh, that's us. that's the next big thing in the right now we are also moving all our servers as we talked about before the show. All our servers are being moved from a server from a server hosting in California to server hosting in Germany, which is happening right now during this interview. So some of our services, if you're trying to visit them, might be a bit funky right now, but it should hopefully clear up over the next few hours, and hopefully everything should be stable by tomorrow. But it's computers, it's electronics. You never know what's going to happen. But what after that move, the next big thing that's going to happen is the Google Coden, which will start for students on November 28th, and we're really looking forward to that. And actually, I just wanna mention something. Speaking of contributions, because I know that one of your favorite languages is, if not your favorite language, is Perl, and Music Brains, the Music Brains server is actually written in Perl, and we're actually. Yeah, like I said, it's 16 years old. Almost all of our other projects are written in Python, but they're also much much younger than Music Brains. But we're actually looking for a Perl programmer. We're not actively looking for one right now because of all the because of the server move going on. But as soon as the server move is done, we're hoping to find another Perl developer to hire part-time to help with the Music Brains code base. So if there's other Perl fans out there that thinks this whole project sounds really, really interesting, maybe start getting a look at the code base now. And if and keep your eyes and ears open, and maybe we'll make an announcement later in the year, in the beginning of next year.
I can only imagine that code that was written 15, 16 years ago in Perl. I don't think even I want to touch that. So I have enough legacy clients from that era that I go, okay, that's back before we had Moose and back before we had Catalyst and a lot of the modern frameworks and modern things we can do with ORMs and stuff.
Moose and Catalyst, so it's not completely, it's not all of the code base isn't 16 years old. There have been a couple of larger rewrites for huge parts of the code base a couple of times, but it's definitely an aging code base.
Yes, okay. Well, you can always keep in mind the totally free site jobs.perl.org is where Perl people tend to find each other, at least high-end Perl people. I'm getting really distracted, though, and we're out of time. So given that we're out of time, is there anything that I didn't cover, that we didn't cover, Jonathan and I didn't cover, that you really sort of want to make sure our audience is aware of before we have to let you go?
I really wanted to get a chance to talk about the Google coding, and we got a chance to talk about that. So,
okay. I think we could have talked to you for another half hour at least about some of the other projects. But we have a limited slot here on Floss Weekly, so I don't really have a chance to do that. But Fresno, it's been wonderful chatting with you. I wish you luck in doing the things you need to do to be a community manager for all these the meta projects as well as the actual projects. And I can see that this is one of those interesting – well, I'll talk about this in the wrap-up instead. But no, thank you for coming on the show and talking about this today.
You don't have to, two questions for me.
You're a coder. Sometimes I leave that out when it's more like a project manager instead of a coder. Okay, so what's your favorite scripting language?
Most of the time when I need to – I don't code that much anymore. And most of the time when I need to do hacks, I usually do it in some kind of shell scripting. But when I need to do more advanced things, I prefer Python.
Okay. Yeah, well, that's why I didn't ask, because I thought what the answer was going to be. Here, this one has a chance. This one has a chance. Unlike Trump today, this one has a chance. Now you know which way I'm biased. The text editor. What do you edit to text in all day?
I usually use the text editors I have open most of the time is either LeafPad or gedit. But whenever I'm in a terminal, I use VI.
I kind of knew that one was going to come up too. Oh, well. See, now you know why I didn't ask the two questions, because sometimes I have this psychic ability to just go, this is not going to turn out well. So anyway, Fresno, thank you for coming on the show, and we'll wish you much success in the future, especially when you get your servers running in another few hours. Thank you.
All right.
That was let me get the full name here. That was Frederick Fresno Olson talking to us about brains. What do you think, Jonathan?
It was a good interview. It was good to meet Fresno, and it seems like an interesting guy. Their project as a whole is very it definitely fills a niche that a lot of us have. A lot of programmers in particular, we are kind of OCD about how all the metadata and everything looks and works and is searchable, and so it's good that there are some people that are paying attention to that and putting resources into it. One thing I found very interesting is that there seems to be a couple of these different issues where there's either legality questions or licensing questions that are just a little bit questionable, but they're going ahead and they're doing what seems to be best for everybody and just kind of skirting by those issues. So that's always interesting to think about too, because that does pop up a lot in open source software, whether it's in licensing or patents, and it's worth thinking about and talking to people about that as well.
Well, that's sort of why I asked that very pointed question, which is that if I'm contributing this data, what license was I contributing it under that lets them resell it back to Google Play and Spotify and places like that that they're clearly having an income stream from? I don't mind they're having an income stream from it, but I also want to make sure that we're all on the same page with that. Now, particularly, you know, there are some people for whom when they make a contribution to something, particularly software that's under, say, the GPL, where they're very, very interested in making sure that nobody does anything that's out of scope for that. Whereas if you're contributing to a project that's more under, say, an Apache license, BSD-style license, and somebody makes some money off it over in the corner by making it part of proprietary stuff, it's less of an issue, it seems, for the people who are into BSD-style licenses. And now I'm going to end up opening up that can of worms for today, and I don't want to go any further with that.
Well, I think you could just boil it down and say, as long as everybody knows what's going to happen up front and everybody's honest and clear about it, then you're good. It's when the people that give code have one idea and then the project has another idea and those two are at odds, that's when problems come up. So it's a good thing that they've thought about it and they've made it clear that's their position.
Right, and without rehashing the whole GPL versus BSD style license thing that I have done probably 6 or 7 times on this show, let me just say that I'm glad there's both styles of licenses out there for when you need them. The other thing I also want to say about today's projects, today, it's just projects, not just one project now, it's all the projects in the Brains family. The Brains family, that's something great TV show coming this fall. The Brains family, it's the sequel to Walking Dead. No. Okay. I got to get out of here. But the thing about it is, it's like this was interesting in that it was a group of programmers coming together, a group of skilled engineers coming together to solve a problem that the common person has, which is, you know, I have music, it's not tagged properly, or, you know, I've downloaded it and it's tagged improperly even from the supplier. How do we get that fixed? And let's do it by community effort. Let's do it by coming together. But there still needs to be the nexus there somewhere. There has to be some sort of way that we can come together. And it's really great that there were the collections of programmers and website developers and people over the years who could develop the APIs, write the software that was cross-platform, because I know I ran it on my Mac just fine, things like that. It ultimately brings us together, and this is solving problems, which is, I think, the best thing that the best thing that open source seems to do as well as it does. I mean, even flashing back last week, where I said, you know, maybe most programmers are drones sitting in front of green screens that are just helping the bottom line of some commercial venture. The thing that excites me about open source is that it's more about helping all of us together. It's a potluck. We all give in a little, we get back a little, and we end up all being better as a result of that. So clearly the Brains umbrella it is clearly in that category of people doing useful things that are helping thousands, if not millions, of people with the coding skills and everything else that they bring to the picture. So I think I've rambled on enough about that. Any last quick things, Jonathan, before I wrap up the show?
Nope. Just it was once again a pleasure to be here, and look forward to the future.
Yeah, great. Well, that was the other wrapping up about the previous show, or the current show, but that's okay. You can even say that again one more time after I do the next part of the last show, which is that coming up next week, we do have OMYZSH, which are tools for managing your ZHH config. I know that Frezza just talked about that he uses big shell scripts and stuff, and ZSH allows you to write really, really complex shell scripts. I often wonder, would Perl have been developed in the early days had ZSH been around at that level at that point? Because ZSH, I've done a lot of things in ZSH scripting that I should not have been able to do, and still I only scratched the surface of what I can do. Apparently, I'm going to learn a lot more about that next week. 2 weeks from now will be my birthday, actually. I'll be all of 55. I can be 55. Okay, now for that, what song was that? Let's identify that. No. Zalando, which is a fashion platform for about 19 million users in Europe, but they've also then outsourced and open sourced a number of their software tools and things like that. So we're going to be talking about the projects that project has been opening. gRPC is after that. That's Google's remote procedure call interface that deals with things like proper encoding of data structures on the wire, high availability, failover, retry, things like that. All the things you have to think about when you're connecting up to a service. So they're going to be dealing with that. Just added to the schedule. I'm really excited about this. This is one of the ones that I actually solicited because I saw something go by on the net about it, is Minoka, which is a general-purpose operating system from scratch, but they are trying to maintain a POSIX-like compatibility layer on the user side. So most applications that are POSIX-compliant, which is most of the stuff that's running on Linux and Unix these days, are going to be able to just drop in and work on that side. They've demonstrated that for a lot of things. Current targets right now are the x86 and the ARM, and they're basically, because they're building up the OS from scratch, they're able to throw away some of the things that we've had to inherit as legacies in the legacy OSs like BSDs and Linuxes and things like that. Linuxes, whatever. We just re-added to the schedule Twine, which is the ability to write story. Oh, now I'm going to get it wrong. Like adventure games, games that are basically scripted games where you choose your own adventure sort of thing. Twine is a very, very cool interface that lets you essentially draw the map of where you want to take your story, your interactive story. Still working on rescheduling Karina. And MongoDB is on the short list. If you go to twit.tv/floss, which is the homepage for this show, you'll find the big spreadsheet, the big Google spreadsheet linked from there of all my upcoming shows and what I'm hoping to plan for all those. We're still looking at some of the things that came from the Red Hat Summit, a couple more still in the works. Still booking the last few weeks of Q4, but I'm opening up Q1 probably this weekend and starting to solicit some more guests, which is why I'm down to my last few again. We have a live stream at 9:30 a.m. Pacific time on Tuesdays at live.twit.tv. You can ask questions. We had a number of questions today from our studio audience, non-studio audience. The opposite of a studio audience. There we go. The audience that is not in the studio, because that would not have been very useful. They'd just be talking to Kevin, which would not be all that useful. All right. You can follow us on Floss Weekly at Google Plus and at Floss Weekly on Twitter. You can follow me at Merlyn, M-E-R-L-Y-N on Twitter. And also Google Plus, Randall L. Schwartz. I have actually nothing to plug. I'm really just sort of taking it easy. I'm applying for some of the new conferences coming up next year. Pretty much all I'm doing. Anything you want to plug there, Jonathan?
No, nothing new to plug in the last 45 seconds since I answered this question.
Jonathan, thank you again for jumping in on the show and asking questions that I hadn't exactly thought to ask. That's even better. I love it when there's two brains tying into today's show again. This is great, though. I did this just before Halloween, or no, just after Halloween. What day is it? Where's the calendar? I gotta go. We'll see you all again next week on Floss Weekly.